Welcome to this lecture, this rather special lecture, where we have Martin Wolfe of the Financial Times. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies here in Oxford. I represent the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society and the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. The Foundation for Law, Justice and Society sponsors this event. It's an independent institution affiliated with the university. And our objective really is to broaden out the sphere of academic work, to make it more accessible to the non-academic world, government, business, international organisations, and so on. It's always therefore a great pleasure, and well within our brief, to be able to welcome a lecturer such as Mr. Wolfe. Well, those of you who read the Financial Times need no introduction to Martin Wolfe. Those of you who don't read the Financial Times, you really ought to. It's well worth it. And there are many of us who look forward to Martin Wolfe's columns each week in the Financial Times. Well, I won't go through his very extensive biography. Of course, as you know, he is the chief economics commentator for the Financial Times. But he's much more than that. So a little bit on his background, studied here in Oxford at Corpus Christi College, first class degree in PPE, for those of you in PPE, and then went on to Nuffield College before becoming the journalist, beginning his career as a journalist, which he, you might say, a career at which he is now at the peak. He's an honorary fellow of Corpus Christi College, honorary fellow of Nuffield College, and has gained many honours and awards of various kinds, both here and abroad. He's also a prolific writer. Apart from his columns in the Financial Times, he's published several books. Fixing Public Finance, I think, is the...
Global Finance.
Sorry?
Public Finance is too difficult. Start with Global.
All right. Anyhow, these are all presumably bestsellers nowadays, given the international environment. He's also, I'm happy to say, just been announced the winner of the James Cameron Prize for Journalism. So congratulations, Martin, on that. Well, the subject of the lecture today is the place of Britain in the future Europe. Well, if anyone perhaps is well qualified to speak about this subject, it's Martin Wolfe. Well, I'm happy to say we did ask him to think about new subjects, which perhaps in a sense he hadn't brought together before. So in a way, these will be original thoughts and ideas on the future of Britain, or at least Britain's future in the European Union. So without more ado, I will ask Martin to take over. He will lecture for 40, 50 minutes or so, and then there'll be questions and answers, and we can go on until he has to leave. So, Martin, thank you for coming. We look forward to your lecture.
I should say, perhaps, that just one small correction on my otherwise very flattering introduction. I left Oxford in 1971 and actually only became a journalist in 1987, which was actually rather rare. I'm one of the very few people that I know of who's a professional journalist, actually, as it were, employed by a newspaper, like Paul Krugman, who continues to be employed by Princeton University. Who didn't start off professional life as a journalist. I actually started off, for better or worse, I'm not quite sure, as an economist at the World Bank, where I was for 10 years, and then I worked for a research institute called the Trade Policy Research Center. So as I like to say, I was an economist once. This lecture has sort of personal historical aspects, which will probably become obvious as I go through it, because I've of course been an economics commentator first as chief leader writer of the Financial Times, and then a chief economics commentator since 1987. And for those of you who know, that pretty well spans the period of the planning for creation of the currency union. the idea actually first emerged in the 70s. I'm not going to go into all that history, Werner Report and so forth. There will be people here who know all about that. But the actual monetary union we have really started off in the late 80s with the establishment of the so-called, or the creation of the group that wrote the so-called Delors Report. And it was largely followed the lines laid out at that time. So my professional life has been spent following this idea. And inevitably, over such a long period, my ideas about it have evolved. And in one respect, at least, I think it's important to say this at the beginning before I go through the lecture and explain what I'm going to say or and work through, which is, as you will be perfectly clear, as I will show you, right at the beginning, I took the view which, as an economist, I've never changed, that this was an immensely risky and probably unwise idea. That making a currency union work between economically and therefore politically, they're very closely related in my view, among countries and economies so different, was likely to prove immensely difficult. And so initially I wrote columns opposing this, and I never ever wrote a column saying this was a great idea. In 1997, the relevance of this will become obvious, I think, if you think about the subject of this lecture. In 97, I wrote a column saying they are now going to do this. It's going to be a big currency union. It's going to include basically everybody. And the UK should really think seriously about joining, despite the obvious economic dangers, because otherwise we are going to end up a semi-detached, if not detached, within the European Union. So that was my position in 97. And then roughly three years later, I changed my mind again. That was the only blip, in which I said the economics are so dreadful that I withdraw what I said earlier. We really shouldn't go into this thing. So I very strongly supported Gordon Brown in his famous war. I mean, it was an intellectual and political war with Tony Blair over whether or not we should go into the euro in the early part of this millennium. And as you all know, for a host of reasons, we didn't in the end. It wasn't just this. It was also a view that there was a great discussion about whether we would have to have a referendum, and if we had a referendum, whether there was any chance of winning it. And I think Tony Blair in the end concluded that he'd lose it and he would have had to have one. So I'm not suggesting that Gordon Brown's opposition was the only factor. So fast forward to where we are now, and I'll just sort of give the big point about this. I think my view back in the 90s about Britain's place in Europe is likely to be proved in one way or the other, really quite profoundly correct by the events of the moment. In essence, what I'm going to argue today, and it's going to take a while to do so, and so I apologize for those who are completely familiar with these arguments, but in essence, what I'm going to argue today is that it has been demonstrated beyond the slightest doubt that those of us who thought that the monetary union as designed could not work were right. By the way, there were lots and lots of people in the continent who thought the same, and pretty well every German economist I knew, and I knew pretty well the whole German economic establishment, thought the same, that as designed it was unlikely to work, but they would try to make it work. They were very unhappy with it. Well, we now know that as designed it doesn't work, and the result of that is very, very clear. It is either going to change or break. And either way, whether it changes or breaks, and I think we don't actually know which it will be, I think it's more likely to change than break. But what's going to emerge from this crisis, without a doubt, is a very different European Union from the one of today or a few years ago. And a fortiori, if the European Union is going to change profoundly, and I will discuss the dimensions of that, or some dimensions of that, that is going to change the relationship of Britain to it. Because it's going to present us with some rather uncomfortable choices that we won't like. At least the English won't like. I'm going to touch on relations between England and Scotland in relation to this, because I think that's one aspect of the question of what happens to Europe may also influence the actual structure of the UK. But the core point is that because the currency union as designed has not worked, because therefore the situation in Europe is going to change profoundly one way or the other, a fortiori, the position of the UK in Europe will also have to change. And it could lead, I think, possibly even quite quickly, to partial or complete exit. That's one possible outcomes. Now, these outcomes are not clear, not certain, and I'm only going to discuss the possibilities. But that's the core of what I want to say today. So with that in mind, let me now go through what I have to say. I'm going to start by giving what I think was the sort of the best sentence. I've quoted myself on this a couple of times in my column. I had a debate in December 1991 in the paper because I was known to be at that stage the FT's only Eurosceptic. Now there are lots more, as you know, but I was then the only quote-unquote Eurosceptic. Now, by most British standards, I was regarded as a wild Europhile, but by the FT standards, as it was then, I was a Eurosceptic. I had a debate with a very distinguished colleague of mine. Some of the older people in this audience will probably remember his byline, Ian Davidson, who was our foreign affairs columnist for many years and passionately Europhile. And I basically said, before I wrote this, you know, what we're trying to do is force countries to have the same money and therefore share monetary institutions. Money is serious stuff. People care about it. They really care about it. And if you mess this up, they're going to get very, very angry. And what's worse, they're going to get very, very angry with one another. And so I summarized this in my last sentence, which is the efforts to bind states together in the European Monetary Union, which was proposed as a great integration project, a great way of strengthening Europe, reinforcing the bonds, bringing Germany, the newly reunified Germany, into the European compact even more closely, may lead instead to a huge increase in frictions among them. If so, the event, the plan, would meet the classical definition of tragedy, namely hubris, arrogance, arte, folly, nemesis, destruction. You will see from that that before I read PP, I actually read classics here. No. And to prove that my view is not entirely wrong, I did a little Google search. This is so easy to find. And I just asked Google to give me some images with Angela Merkel as a Nazi. And I assure you, if you go out there, there are thousands of them. This happened to come from a Greek paper. Obviously, you can see that. I don't know the date, but there are lots of them. And I think it can be safely said from my discussions around Europe, I've been talking to a lot of people in Spain, in Italy, that relations among the peoples of Europe have not been radically improved by the experience of this crisis. Therefore, my concern that it might undermine the sense of solidarity rather than strengthen it when crisis hit, and crises always hit international monetary arrangements, have surely been turned out to be realistic concerns. So what I'm going to do, with that as the background, is divide my talk into two parts, but the larger part will be the first. The first part will to be an analysis of what this crisis is about and why, to resolve it, it is necessary, and I think there's no real question about it, but I will go through the argument anyway, why, to resolve it, it is necessary to bring about really quite deep reforms in the way the Eurozone works, whose net effect, if they work, will be greatly to increase the integration among Eurozone states. That is the only way they can satisfactorily solve this crisis, is greatly to increase the integration among Eurozone states, which obviously has profound economic and political implications. Assuming that, and I will discuss some of the dimensions of that, and assuming that is the case, I will then discuss in a relatively short second part what those outcomes including the possibility that they won't actually reach such agreements and it won't work, what those outcomes might mean for the UK, or as we always call it the UK, but you call it Britain. You understand why we call it the UK, because Britain, of course, is wrong. It's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and we're not allowed to forget the last bit. That may not continue indefinitely, but... So let me talk a bit about the Eurozone crisis. And it's very important to understand it. In essence, and I will try to explain this for those... for economists, you're probably all pretty familiar with my line of argument, but there is a view in the Eurozone that it's essentially a fiscal crisis, very much associated with Germany, that what went wrong is a number of countries behave very badly fiscally, and they're being duly and properly punished. But this view, this interpretation is, in my view, fundamentally mistaken economically. It's essentially a balance of payments financing crisis, a cross-border balance of payments financing crisis. And for somebody who spent a lot of time working on developing countries, which is why I mentioned the fact that I was worked at the World Bank, I'm very familiar with crises like this. And where Spain is, leaving aside the fact that it's in the currency union, is really not terribly different from where Argentina was in 2000. In the run-up to the crisis, there were gigantic internal capital flows, also from abroad, but mainly internal, from surplus countries, saving surplus to savings deficit countries. These capital flows drove huge current account imbalances, surpluses, deficits, and generated, because of the booms associated with them in the capital receiving countries, huge and cumulative divergences in competitiveness, in unit labour costs, in the production of tradable goods and services. After 2008, cross-border private financial flows suffered a series of what economists who are experts on the financing of developing countries or of emerging countries call, particularly Latin American economists, sudden stops. The characteristic of financial markets, actually, it happened in the private financial market in the Lehman crisis, and it's happened now in a series of stages within the Eurozone. Private capital just stops. And worse, it starts flowing out. So large current account deficits that used to be easily financed by private capital are quite suddenly no longer financeable. And when that happens, the economies start to implode. Private financial sector is starved of funds. It has to withdraw credit. All credit gets cut off from the private sector. Companies go bankrupt. Workers are sacked. Prices of assets which are backed, which are being supported by flows of funding, particularly housing, collapse, and fiscal revenue collapses, government spending on unemployment benefit explodes, you end up with a collapsed economy and a huge fiscal deficit. None of that is new. That's basically what has happened in a rolling wave of crises to five Eurozone countries. Italy is a little different. We can discuss that perhaps later, but that's core what happened. Now, because the view that this is a fiscal crisis has allowed and allows the creditor countries simply to blame the debtors. They say it's all their fault, but I think this is bad economics and even worse politics. It ends you up with the sort of pictures I just showed you for Angela Merkel in that uniform. The correct view that this is a financial crisis, if understood, puts blame on both creditors and debtors. And I think that's much better economics and better politics, and it would allow a more satisfactory resolution, which I'll come to later on. Now, let me just indicate why it's very difficult to argue that the run-up to this crisis was triggered by fiscal policy predominantly. There are five countries that are now in trouble: Greece, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. And you will see that Greece and Italy had quite high debt beforehand. Greece is, in fact, the one real poster boy, as it were, for the thesis that it's a fiscal crisis. But you will see that Ireland and Spain had among the lowest net public debt positions in the Eurozone before the crisis. Only Finland was clearly better. Ireland had almost no public debt before the crisis. And Portugal, though, had a significant public debt. It was actually very close to France. So for three of the countries, it's absolutely clear that the fiscal position is not a significant explanation for the fact that they're in crisis. It's something else. And it's also clear, very, very important, that at least in the case of Greece, Portugal, Spain and Ireland, Italy again is an exception, because essentially Italy's public debt problem is a consequence of the debt it accumulated before it joined the Eurozone, that is to say in the 80s and early 90s. But in all the other cases, there were gigantic explosions in fiscal debt after the crisis hit. The fiscal crisis is a consequence of the financial crisis, not a cause. By the way, of course, exactly the same is true for the UK and US, but that's a completely different story. Even in the case of Greece, you can see that between 2007 and 2014, this is the current forecast for these countries after the debt resolution. So the Greek debt exploded even more than I show you here. And in Spain and Ireland, you can see it also in Portugal too, massive increases in public debt after the crisis hit. I'll just focus on Spain and Ireland because, as I told you, they had no fiscal problems that were visible before the crisis started. So how was it possible for this to happen? I'll start with Ireland because it is, I think, the most extraordinary picture I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of fiscal crises. And there was Ireland, happily with net public debt of 11% of GDP. It was about as solvent as you can imagine. And there is Ireland 5 years later with net public debt of more than 100% of GDP. 5 years from basically nothing to 100% of GDP. How did this happen? Well, roughly speaking, a third of this happened because they decided, or were forced, actually, partly were forced, it's a bit of a very complicated story, to bail out the creditors of their banks, most of whom, in this case, were from the rest of the continent, also the UK, by the way, from the rest of the EU, and partly because of gigantic recessions which generated enormous fiscal deficits. In, I think it was 2011, I may have got this wrong, Ireland's fiscal deficit, general government borrowing requirement, was more than 30% of GDP in 1 year. So their debt problem is a consequence of the crisis, and Spain is more or less the same story, just not quite as extreme. So the fiscal crises we perceive now in Ireland, Spain and Portugal, not in Italy, and in Greece it's a 50-50 story, were a consequence of the crisis, not a cause of this. What does distinguish the countries that got into a crisis? And the answer of this for that is very, very simple. If you take the current account balances, which is just the other way around of the net capital inflow, the two are mirror images of each other. The current account deficit is by definition a capital account surplus. That's accounting. You will see that I put in Estonia as well, though I'm not going to talk about it anymore. It's just a different story, not in the Eurozone, but very interesting story. The countries that got into deficit, particularly Portugal, Greece and Spain, Ireland is slightly less. It's a domestic boom more than a capital inflow boom. The characteristic they had was gigantic current account deficits, i.e. gigantic capital inflows. And these countries, in a really very short period, in the euphoria of the creation of the Eurozone, in the confidence that now capital flows were going to be safe, which was actually the aim of creating the Eurozone, the goal was to create these capital flows, moved integration of the capital markets, move from being pretty close to having zero net external liability positions to net external liabilities of close to 100% of GDP in these cases, in about a decade. And the creditors, when they finally realised what they had lent to, predominantly large private sector financial booms, though not exclusively so, took flight, and that then drove them into crisis. And meanwhile, of course, the countries that are not in crisis are the ones that ran surpluses before the crisis And the distinction is really pretty clear. Basically, the continued borrowers are in crisis, and the ones that provided the money are the ones who are not in crisis. Now, as I said, these inflows of funds, again, it's less true for Italy and Portugal, every story is a bit different, triggered very large booms in the domestic economy, very large asset price booms, and in cases of Ireland and Spain, very large construction booms, all of which drove up wages across the whole economy. This figures for unit labour costs, which is fundamental competitiveness in manufacturing, is just the best proxy I have for competitiveness in the production of tradable goods and services. It's not perfect, but it allows for productivity and wages. And by the way, 100 is Germany. So it's relative to Germany. And it starts in 1999, which is pretty well the beginning of the euro, and it goes up to today. And you can see that unit labour costs in Greece rose by 80% relative to Germany. In Italy and Spain, they rose between 30 and 50%. In Portugal, about 20%. The only country that doesn't have a significant competitiveness problem, and this is shown very clearly in its performance, by the way, on the external account, is Ireland. So all these countries have lost competitiveness on a very, very large way. Nobody knows precisely how much that has to be regained for growth to return, to be able to grow while having financeable current account deficits. Then it's clearly not going to be able to run current account deficits of 10% of GDP anymore. But it's clear that they're going to have to revert this to some extent. There are only two ways you can recoup unit labour costs in this way. One is to have an enormous rise in productivity, and that means an enormous increase in unemployment. That has actually happened in Spain to some degree, and it's a complicated story, but it's one of the reasons why Spain's unemployment rate is today 25%. And it is going to get higher. And the other way you can do it is by reducing nominal wages relative to Germany. Now, since nominal wages in Germany are rising 2%, maybe in a good year 3% or so, that means essentially if you don't want for this process to go on for the next 20 years, you want nominal wages to fall by about 2, 3, 4% a year. There is no developed country that has managed to generate falling nominal wages of 2, 3 or 4% a year since the Great Depression. And it's pretty clear from experience now that you need monstrous levels of unemployment to generate such an outcome. In Spain, nominal wages are still rising, even though there are 25% unemployment. So this method of adjustment really doesn't work in the Eurozone. And that was the main reason I thought the Eurozone couldn't be made to work in the long run. The labour markets just don't work that way. And they don't work in any modern developed country. Nominal wage falls are very, very difficult and painful to achieve. And they have to go a very long way. And because it's going to be so slow, they're stuck in recessions, I think, for a very long time. I've just got this chart which illuminates this crucial point. Remember, you've got a Eurozone where the inflation target is 2%. Productivity growth is close, very low, 1%. So for Germany to be consistent, I mean, I'm being very simple, but a 3% inflation, 3% nominal wage growth is roughly consistent with 2% domestic inflation, which is what the Germans want. So they're going to have 3% nominal wage growth. The other countries need falling nominal wages. And this, I'll come to this other point in a moment. One of the big implications of that is that, of course, if there are going to be falling nominal wages to get your competitiveness back, your real debt problem is going to get worse. This is debt deflation. Irving Fisher wrote about that in his very famous and important article about the Great Depression in 1933, the debt deflation theory of Great Depressions, one of the seminal works in macroeconomics, I think. And unfortunately, that is part of the problem. As you drive down nominal wages and nominal GDP falls as well because of that and because of the recessions, debt burdens rise. And that's part of what we are seeing. And it gets much worse if, as I will soon show you, interest rates explode upwards. And incidentally, that is, of course, why Mario Draghi has just committed himself to buy lots and lots of bonds to get interest rates down. So important. Anyway, this chart comes from the Bruegel institute, very good institute in the commission, in Brussels, in not the commission, in Brussels, and it shows what's happened to compensation per employee, just nominal wages, up to the end of the boom, 2008, and between 2008 and 2011. It's very, very striking. What it shows you first is, as everybody knows, German nominal wages basically didn't grow after the entry into the Eurozone. They first regained lost competitiveness, and then they became hyper-competitive. Everybody else had explosive growth in nominal wages. You look at Greece, look at Ireland, look at Spain. Italy actually also had relatively contained growth of nominal wages, but very, very low productivity growth, which is why you saw the story that I showed you. Now let's look at, we've had this crisis since 2008. Are we beginning to see nominal wages falling in these countries relative to Germany? Remember, these figures are cumulative over 3 years, and the answer is for Greece and Ireland, we are. Ireland is actually in reasonable shape. Greece is just so uncompetitive, it's got so long to go. Spain is gaining not at all on Germany, and Italy is hardly gaining, and so is Portugal. At this rate, restoring competitiveness is going to take 20 years. That's not politically possible. Putting countries into deflation for 20 years is not politically possible. It will blow up, in my view. Okay. So why were proponents of the Eurozone unaware of the dangers of cross-border financial flows and current account imbalances? Well, partly they actually thought these flows were the purpose of the exercise. I've already mentioned that. Why do you want to integrate the economy? So you've got integrated capital markets like the US. That was the idea. They thought that the only serious currency risk to the continuation of these flows was currency risk. And they thought they had eliminated currency risk. These were the three assumptions. I always thought these were wrong, and they were wrong because, one, currency risk is not the only thing that threatens the continuation of capital flows. If people think there is serious credit risk in the countries to which they've lent, either fiscal or in the private sector. And it's very easy to see why they thought there was serious cross-country credit risk emerging. And in any case, currency risk cannot be eliminated so long as the possibility of breakup secession remains. You can't tell people that there is no currency risk unless they're absolutely, truly certain that the Eurozone will continue to exist. And it's very difficult to convince people of that when you're in a crisis like this. There's just nothing you can do to convince people of it. And the more you say it's this case, the less they believe you. So it's a very real problem. The elimination of currency risk is much, much harder than people thought. And again, if I may say so, I did recognize that. I didn't recognize everything, but I recognize that. Remember that even regions within countries can suffer the consequences of current account imbalances. If we did current account balances, we find that if you took out the fiscal account, the northeast of England looks awful. But we are financing the northeast of England, we collectively. There's a huge flow into it through the fiscal accounts. There's no doubt about that at all. For regions with, this is just the obvious point, regions within countries that get in difficulty, mechanisms for handling the worst consequences of severe regional busts, in this case, the collapse of the old industrial base of the northeast, do exist. I'm not saying they're ideal, but they exist. There is support of the financial system, so there's no question of the northeastern financial system disappearing. Northern Rock was a part of the northeastern financial system all on its own. If the northeast were a country, Northern Rock would have gone down, and it wouldn't, much of the financial system would have gone. But it was backed by London, and so the financial system continued to function throughout. And the same happened in the United States during this last crisis. None of the state, if New York State had to support the banks based in New York in this crisis, there will no longer be any banks left in New York, and New York would cease to have a banking system. But they have the federal government. The federal government exists precisely to deal with crises of this kind ever since the 30s. There are fiscal transfers which are automatic and built into perfectly standard welfare state systems. And of course, in most countries, there's relatively great labor mobility. These aren't perfect mechanisms, but they work adequately. The Eurozone member countries don't have mechanisms of support of this kind. They're essentially, from an adjustment point of view, in a gold standard type of mechanism, with one important exception, which I'll come to in a moment. And so the adjustment mechanism, when things go wrong, is the classic gold standard mechanism. It's called depression. That's how adjustment works. It was completely obvious that that was the adjustment mechanism, which is why I was against it, except for my 3 bad years. So it never seemed very plausible that this mechanism could be made to work. And I've thrown in this little point, a very senior Italian official who is now a member of the government, a minister, told me when I discussed this very mechanism, I said, how are you going to get the Italians to accept falling nominal wages for the next 20 years? And he said, it's not going to happen. We are not Latvia. And he was referring, of course, to a country which has accepted very painfully, very slowly, but still has accepted for a whole host of reasons which are built into the history of Latvia, also Estonia, falling nominal wages. The one thing they did have was a central bank. And that makes a difference. The central bank printed money, has been printing money on a large scale, and has used that to finance current account deficits. My friend Hans-Werner Sinn, professor in Munich, and the head of SISIFO, a very important German institution, has been complaining about this and making trouble about this in Germany now for some years. But as Spain has discovered, support from the European Central Bank, even though it has been provided, particularly to its banking system, in liquidity support, is not the same as having one's own central bank. And this contrast between Spain and the UK is very striking. They have remarkably similar fiscal situations, similarly bust banks, I think, but totally different interest rates on public debt. Either governments are fundamentally in quite different positions in terms of creditworthiness. And as Paul de Groot, the very distinguished Belgian economist, has now at the LSE has pointed out, this is explained by the very different liquidity, currency and default risks of the countries. So here I've put Spain and UK. I think this is a rather remarkable picture. You can see from this, if you look at it, you'll see that according to the IMF, this may be true or not, public debt in the UK is both higher than and growing faster than Spain. So the UK has a really pretty damn bad public debt position, so it should really have a rather serious debt interest problem. This is what's happened to the yields on government bonds of Spain and the UK in the last 4 years. In the UK, there is essentially no default risk. There's inflation risk for sure, but nobody believes we're going to have inflation given the recession in our economy. And so what's happened in the UK with a central bank, which is clearly not going to ever be allowed to allow the British government actually to default, we'll just buy the bonds, the long-term interest rates on UK gilts have fallen to less than 2%, which is the lowest interest rate on UK gilts in the entire history of UK gilts, which is more than 300 years. That's a remarkable fact. That's a really remarkable fact. Spain, on the other hand, has unfortunately had a lot of problems with public debt. And even after the recent announcements that the Bank of ECB would buy some bonds, but nobody knows how much, what conditions and so forth, interest rates remain very, very high. The conclusion is that high-income countries embedded inside a currency union are more vulnerable to balance of payments come financial crises than countries with floating exchange rates in their own central banks. They are, in fact, more like emerging countries with exceptionally hard exchange rate pegs. And the idea that eliminating currency crises would eliminate crises as such was a very big intellectual error. The currency union replaced the brief currency crisis of the exchange rate mechanism, painful, disruptive, all the other, with what is going to turn out to be long-running solvency, employment, and political crisis. And that, I think, is where they are. And the symptoms of all this are pretty obvious: dwindling cross-border finance, capital flight, bank runs, all going on at the moment, private retrenchment, collapsing GDP, soaring unemployment, exorbitant bond yields in deficit countries, very rapidly tightening links between domestic banks and their governments, because the domestic banks are the only people still willing to buy the bonds of their governments, or being forced, not willing, political and economic stress, and the rising political friction I've already shown you. So this is what happened to the debt interest rates of Portugal, Greece and Ireland, the spreads over bunds, which is obviously the safe haven Eurozone. This is a classic market phenomenon, getting everything wrong. 4 years ago, the spreads were zero. Everybody thought, were behaving as if the risk on Greek, Irish or Portuguese debt was zero. And then when people suddenly realised that was a rather serious mistake, the credit spreads blew out and all three countries essentially had to be rescued by a combination of the Eurozone governments or the European governments. The UK was involved with Ireland and the IMF. And slowly but painfully, they're bringing the spreads down on Ireland and Portugal, but they still remain very high, and with the current levels of debt, I think really unsustainably high. And this is what has happened to the two much more important countries because of their size, Spain and Italy. Again, this starts in 2008, so the spreads were close to zero. France even also has had wobbles, but the spreads remain manageable so far. But Spain and Italy have both, I don't have the time to explain this, have had blowouts on their spreads which generate real interest rates which are not sustainable. And they're certainly not sustainable for Italy, which has a net debt ratio of 100% and a gross debt ratio of 120%, has very low trend growth and is now shrinking. I'll show you that in a minute. These are unsustainable debt paths. And again, this shows it more clearly, the reduction brought about by the announcement of the outright monetary transactions has been inadequate to bring these spreads down to clearly sustainable levels, given the large deficits and the large debt rollover problem. Just to indicate the scale of the significance in the case of Italy, should it be forced to restructure its debt, and it is on a path now to being forced, Italy is the world's third largest debtor after the US and Japan. So we are talking about a very major credit risk event out there in the Eurozone context. I've already mentioned to you, it's a very important point, that part of the crisis is that finance has gone back home. Domestic banks have been forced, and domestic citizens have been forced to back into holding their own liabilities of their own governments. And this shows, this is the foreign holdings of the Spanish government bonds over the just continent last year. And you can see that foreign holdings collapse because foreigners are just selling out. But what's gone up overwhelmingly is domestic bank holdings. So if Spain were forced to restructure its debt, its banks would go down because the link is so incredibly close. And in Italy too, though to a lesser degree, the same phenomenon can be seen in the last two or three quarters, the very rapid shift. Today, 20% of Italian debt is held by Italian banks. In 2008, it wasn't much more than 10%. It's a very big change in the system. The unemployment rates have gone through the roof. This is Spain, 25%. Nobody knows in Greece, in truth, but it's at least 20%. Ireland, 15%. Portugal, 15%. And it's certain these figures will get worse over the next two or three years. So how might the Eurozone solve all this? And this is crucial for getting to the core of what the end of what I want to say. How might it solve this? Well, there are basically two scenarios, what I call the catastrophic and the very painful. The catastrophic is partial or complete breakup. I think that will be a traumatic economic and political event for Europe. And I think much more important than that, I think it, is what most of the policymakers think. The painful is simply an extended and painful period of adjustment via depression and structural reform. If they're going to manage this process, and here I'm not talking about the longer term reforms, there are basically three things they're going to have to do. These are the tests of whether they're going to succeed. First, they're going to have to be large debt write-offs to clear up the legacy costs of the poorly structured and managed currency union, Mark I, with the creditors taking losses. And that means a lot of the creditors taking losses will be now be official creditors. Second, there's going to have to be continued ongoing financing of countries that simply cannot manage these adjustments quickly enough, to prevent financial, fiscal and economic collapses or meltdowns. By financing, I mean enough outside resources to maintain a working financial system and manageable costs of government funding so governments can continue to provide the essential public goods needed for their society. It's not clear that Greece is in this situation anymore. And adjustment, which is the thing I expect, structural reforms and divergent inflation across the Eurozone with higher inflation and stronger final demand in core countries. And this whole process I've defined is, if you're incredibly optimistic, 5 years, but I suspect realistically, 10 years or so. We took 10 years to get here, and it's going to take, I think, that long to get out of it. And then beyond that, once you've just fixed the problems, you then have to think about how it might work in the long run, and that's part of the solution as well, to make this sort of mess a one-off rather than a repeated event. Essentially, first, and these are widely understood, and the need for a banking union, which means no more than that the European banking system will be managed, financed, and backed like the US one. That is to say, it will be federalized in one way or other. That's what a banking union means. It means European supervision under the European Central Bank. It means shared fiscal resources. It's a mini fiscal union. It's absolutely clear what that means. It means that the Spanish banks are backed by the union, not just by Spanish government, which is no longer capable of doing that. It means an adequate safety net for governments so that they can continue to function, provide the essential public goods that peoples expect in crises. There are many ways to do this. You can do it through Eurobonds, which are probably the best way. A bigger European stability mechanism plus strong European central bank support is another. They're moving towards that. I agree with the Germans that a permanent large-scale transfer union is undesirable, but the safety nets have to be bigger. You cannot impose the sort of fiscal adjustments that are now being imposed in peripheral, in weaker countries, without risking serious social, political, and economic breakdown. And you need a very supportive central bank. And indeed, Mario Draghi has moved a long way in that direction. And I, by the way, I think regard the fiscal compact in its present form as unworkable, though I understand its political necessity. I don't have time to go into this. In practice, we found that willingness to act was substantial once it became obvious that the original design had failed, but it has so far been insufficient to resolve the crisis. And the obstacles are of three main kinds. First, there are some really big economic problems here. It's just hard to make this work, particularly given the problems of competitiveness that have now emerged. There are huge ideological stresses here because the differences in perspective among countries on how economies should work are simply so large, and that's always been obvious. And the difficulties are also political. The countries and peoples don't like one another very much. They don't trust one another very much. And it's much worse in all respects than it was 4 or 5 years ago. That just happens to be a reality. And of course, doing the reforms that I've suggested all raise huge questions about political legitimacy. So I tend to summarize very briefly, we're either going to have a really rather bad marriage or an incredibly horrible divorce. Now, what does all that mean for us? So the last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, what does this mean for us? If I may say us, I think there are lots of people in the audience who wouldn't think of this as for us, but I do, because I'm a citizen of this country. I was born here. My parents didn't came here voluntarily, but I have to say this, and it's probably only fair to say, I'm the child of refugees from Hitler's Europe, and my tendency tends to be, so they made a mess of it? What's a surprise? Now, okay, I shouldn't have said that, but I did. Well, whatever happens, the world has changed. Whatever happens, the world has changed. But the nature of the change depends on the outcome for the Eurozone, over which Britain has very little, if any, influence. These are decisions that are going to be taken in the Eurozone, predominantly in Berlin, let's be completely realistic about it, and along the long list of things that Angela Merkel and her colleagues are interested in, the views of Britain probably figure about number 100. So, you know, effectively, we are bystanders. And we've worked very hard to become bystanders, not only by not joining, which I think was a completely right decision, but by being exceptionally small-minded and difficult in recent years under the idiot we have in number 10. And you all know, surely, that I think he is. So there's no news about that. So the way I analyse the question is, as I suggested earlier, the status quo in the Eurozone is untenable for reasons that I hope I've explained. That was the main purpose, to show the status quo is untenable. And therefore, the Eurozone will either fragment in some way or become much more homogeneous, becoming more homogeneous by fragmenting, so the pieces really fit together. You've got something much more like what the economists think of as an optimal currency union, or it will become much more integrated. If the Eurozone fragments, I'm just going through the ifs, and I'm not, by the way, I should have said this a minute, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to discuss all the legal ramifications and the fact you will all tell me it's legally impossible and it can't happen. My view on the law is the states do what they need to do to survive and then they sort out the law. So I have a what I think of as the Roman view of how you deal with the safety of the Republic is the supreme law. So if the state feels it's being broken, it will change. But you will now tell me that is vile and immoral and wicked, but that's my view. So I'm assuming that the law will be sorted out if the states decide that the status quo is truly, utterly intolerable. But it's obviously part of the cost. If the Eurozone were to survive, it might do so in one big block. But I'm talking about partial fragmentation, minus, say, one country. There is a lot of talk about the possibility of making Greece the sacrificial goat. Or after the exit of creditor nations. I've been trying to encourage that recently, trying to suggest to Germany that maybe it should consider leaving, and that would simplify life. It's not, going to happen. Or it might be the exit of a group of debtor nations, and that might follow a major crisis in Spain and Italy, in which the country's governments are basically forced to default and their banking systems collapse. My basic view on this, I should be clear about, I should have perhaps said this, is I think countries, modern countries, can stand the restructuring of their, they can stand having insolvent governments, and they can stand having collapsed banks, but they can't stand having both. So, very simple. If you've got all your banks collapse, but you have a solvent government which can restore, remanage, recreate the banking system, that's workable. And you can, if the banks go on and this, your government goes down, you've got still got an economy, but you can't lose both. Once you lose both, you're out of here and you're another monetary system. And that is a real danger. This combination of losing the banks and the government is not impossible in this situation, and that would lead to a group of debtor nations creating a new currency. If it breaks up in whole or in part, as you will tell me, the EU will be in a legal limbo, since of course its members are required to be in the Eurozone. How they fix that, I don't know. The UK will then need to decide on where it would fit into an EU that would follow a partial or complete breakup of the Eurozone. I'm not putting probabilities on this event, maybe zero, it may be, but I suspect it's definitely larger than zero. But such a world is so unpredictable. How it would play out is so wild that I think it's almost impossible to plan for it. But it's quite likely in such a world, the EU single market, the EU as we know it, just wouldn't be around anymore. It's a break point. And the break point basically occurs because in the end, the Germans decide we don't want this game anymore. I'm not predicting that this is likely, but that's what we're talking about. Now, if the Eurozone stays together, it follows from my argument, it will have to become a banking union, at the very least, which will force it to become a fiscal union in significant part, genuinely shared fiscal resources. And that will mean much more fiscal and financial discipline and much more fiscal and financial support. It will really mean a big step, an important step towards federation. There's no doubt. And that will have very big political implications, legitimacy questions, which are very important. But it would clear that if that happened, it would completely transform Britain's positions. Since the questions that it is most concerned about, how the financial system works, how the banking system works, how the single market works, will clearly be decided inside the Eurozone. There's no doubt that's what would happen. That is what this means. And it's quite particularly true of finance. So our position will become that in the most important, some of the most important areas of policy affecting Britain, we would essentially have no voice at all. That seems to me where we would be if that were to happen. So what would we might we then do in response to this other world of the much more tightly integrated, as it were, more Germanic Eurozone? Well, we could join the Eurozone. I think the chance of a British government getting that through in the near future is close to zero, but it's not impossible in the long run. Staying inside the EU and accepting the outcome of Eurozone decisions, over which Britain would have next to no influence. Seeking to move into the European economic area, so you just make up your mind that you are going to have to live this anyway. Accepting that we have no influence on single market regulation. And, of course, that would have the advantage of putting us outside a number of rather unpopular policies. So that would be one possible outcome. We could go even further, move into EFTA. But of course, if we took any of these moves, there will be response of the members in the Eurozone to those options. And it's clearly not, it's definitely not clear what choices they would make in response to what would now become a problematic game with a difficult outsider. And beyond this, and this is my very last slide, political implications are worth thinking about. It is clear that in either direction, towards disintegration or much greater integration, we are talking about massive upheavals in relations among members of the Eurozone and members of the EU outside the Eurozone. One possibility, as I said, is that if the Eurozone became more federal and we, as it were, Britain as a whole, decided to stay out of it, that parts of Britain would decide that actually they wanted to be in it. And by parts of Britain, I mean, of course, Scotland. So one of the interesting questions is what pressure this sort of scenario would put on the United Kingdom as a whole. And we are seeing similar sorts of stresses occurring, though in a rather different context, on other multinational, quote-unquote, unions, and particularly Spain, right in the moment. And the biggest point of all, and it's my very last point, since I've gone over a little bit longer than I'd hoped, the biggest point of all is that because of the scale and significance of this crisis and the difficulty of working through it, the future of the EU as a whole has now become wildly unpredictable in a whole host of directions and will depend, I'm quite sure, on the decisions of a very small number of individuals under stress. For that reason, it necessarily follows, since that's true of the future of the EU, the same is true of the future of Britain in the EU. So if somebody told me that by 2020 we're no longer inside it because of some events that have occurred between now and then, and I could see various scenarios, I would find that perfectly credible. So I've done my best to go through what the crisis is, why it's so significant, why it must transform the EU in one way or the other, and why that must have profound implications for and create deep choices, profound choices for the UK. But predicting exactly what they would be and how they might play out is, I think, at the moment impossible, which makes my life at least very, very interesting. That's my lecture.